The deacon was 59 years old when they put the noose around his neck. He had not been tried in a court that had jurisdiction over him. He had not been given more than 48 hours from arrest to execution. He had been transferred by boat from Kingston to Morant Bay, specifically to place him under military law rather than civilian law, where a jury might have acquitted him. The governor of Jamaica signed the order himself, and when John Stuart Mill brought the full documented evidence before Parliament in London, demanding a murder prosecution, England looked at everything and chose the governor. That choice is the thing, not the rebellion, not even the massacre that followed it. The choice made in committee rooms in London by men who had read every report is the story this episode is actually telling. Paul Bogle is a Baptist deacon in Stony Gut, a community east of Morant Bay on Jamaica's southeastern coast that he helped establish and build on purchased land. He is a registered voter, one of the very few black men in Jamaica for whom the property qualification could be met. He has used that standing. He has written letters to the governor's office. He has circulated petitions among the laboring class of St. Thomas in the Vale. He has documented the conditions: wages below subsistence level, land rents rising while wages fell, magistrates who tried and convicted black workers on the sworn testimony of planters with direct financial interest in the verdicts. In June of 1865, Bogle organized a delegation and walked on foot more than 40 miles to Spanish Town to meet with Governor Edward John Eyre personally. The purpose was to present these grievances through the official channel. Eyre refused to meet them. He sent word that the delegation's concerns had been noted and dismissed. What follows is not impulsive. Bogle spent months after that refusal, continuing to organize, corresponding with George William Gordon, a mixed-race member of the Jamaican House of Assembly, the son of a Scottish planter and an enslaved woman, now a property owner, a legislator, and a vocal critic of Eyre in the press and the Assembly chamber. Gordon had helped Bogle purchase land at Stony Gut. The two men shared a political alignment. The colonial administration was systematically impoverishing the black and mixed-race laboring class of Jamaica 27 years after emancipation, and the legal structures that were supposed to address that were controlled by the same planter class doing the impoverishing. On October 11th, 1865, Bogle leads a column of several hundred men and women to the Morant Bay courthouse. They carry sticks. Some have cutlasses. The vestry inside is in session. The colonial militia opens fire into the crowd. What happened in the seconds before the first shot remains contested. The colonial records say Bogle's group attacked first. The accounts of participants say the militia fired without provocation. Seven policemen die in the confrontation. Approximately 18 members of Bogle's group are killed in the courthouse yard. The building is set on fire during the fighting. Governor Eyre declares martial law within hours. Over the next 30 days, under the cover of martial law, British soldiers and a Maroon auxiliary force move through the parishes of St. Thomas. 439 people are killed, 604 are flogged, including women. More than 1,000 homes are burned. Many of those executed are not charged with any specific act. Many are killed on suspicion of geographical or social proximity to the rebellion. A man found with a wound from any cause was treated as evidence of participation and executed without trial. The soldiers work with speed, the colonial reports describe as efficiency. The records do not capture all of it, and those records were kept by the people conducting the operations. Here is the detail that rarely makes the summary accounts of the 439 people killed in those 30 days. The majority had no documented connection to the October 11th courthouse confrontation. They were farmers, day laborers, people who lived within walking distance of where someone else had fired a weapon. The colonial designation for what happened is pacification. What the demographics of the dead describe is the systematic destruction of a resistant laboring population in a productive agricultural district, carried out under martial law with the full military capacity of the British Empire. George William Gordon is in Kingston when the rebellion breaks. He has no documented presence at Morant Bay on October 11th. He is arrested in Kingston, which is not under martial law. Governor Eyre orders him transferred by steamer to Morant Bay, which is... The transfer takes deliberate legal coordination. In Kingston, Gordon falls under civilian law and faces a civilian jury. The evidence against him, primarily that he had corresponded with Bogle and given public speeches criticizing colonial governance, is thin enough that acquittal is plausible. In Morant Bay, Gordon falls under the court-martial that Eyre controls directly. The tribunal convenes, reviews the evidence, deliberates for a matter of hours. Gordon is hanged on October 23, 1865. The record of that transfer, the deliberate movement of a civilian prisoner from a civilian legal jurisdiction into a military one for the purpose of obtaining a verdict unavailable in the civilian courts, is not a secret. It is documented in the Colonial Office files. It is what John Stuart Mill reads when he decides to pursue a criminal prosecution. The Jamaica Committee forms in England in early 1866. Mill is its organizing force. The membership includes Thomas Henry Huxley, naturalist and Darwin's most effective public defender. They compile survivor testimony. They document the executions, the floggings, the burned homes, the jurisdictional transfer. They file a criminal complaint against Eyre for the murder of Gordon, specifically for the unlawful transfer of a civilian prisoner into a military jurisdiction for the purpose of a capital verdict. The legal argument is precise. This is not a political grievance. It is a procedural crime. The Eyre Defense Fund forms almost immediately in response. Its membership includes Thomas Carlyle, John Ruskin, Alfred Lord Tennyson, and Charles Dickens. The argument is not primarily procedural. It is racial. The argument runs, in various registers, like this. The black population of Jamaica was on the verge of a catastrophe that would have consumed the island. Eyre moved with necessary force in time to prevent it. The civilization of the Caribbean required the kind of swift authority that civilian courts would have delayed into irrelevance. Bogle's march, in this framing, was not a political protest. It was the first act of a race war. Three separate attempts to prosecute Eyre follow over the next 2 years. A grand jury in London refuses to indict. A formal prosecution for high crimes and misdemeanors encounters jurisdictional objections. A final private prosecution collapses when English courts hold that military officers acting under martial law orders are immune from civilian criminal liability for acts committed under those orders. Eyre's never tried. He retires to a country house in Devon on a government pension. He dies in 1891 at the age of 79. The legal reasoning shifts in each prosecution attempt. The grand jury cites insufficient evidence. The high crimes charge runs into questions about parliamentary sovereignty. The immunity ruling invokes the law of war. The reasons are different every time, but the outcome is the same every time. Paul Bogle and George William Gordon are declared national heroes of Jamaica in 1969. They are two of the seven official national heroes, and the only two who were executed by the colonial government. Bogle's face appears on the Jamaican $2 coin. Gordon's appears on the $100 note. Their names are on streets, schools, and public buildings across the island. The Maroon Auxiliary Forces from a Kampong town, who participated in the suppression, occupy a more complicated place in Jamaican historical memory. Under the Treaty of 1739, signed by the Maroon leader Cudjoe at the end of the First Maroon War, the Maroon communities had a formal contractual obligation to the British Crown that included returning escaped enslaved people and assisting in the suppression of rebellions. That clause was invoked in 1865. Historians of Caribbean resistance have not fully resolved what it means that black freedom purchased through one treaty was made to suppress black resistance under that same treaty. The Kampong Town Maroons and the broader Jamaican community have had that conversation continuously since independence. It is not settled. The reparations dimension of the Morant Bay Rebellion is active. CARICOM's formal reparations framework, developed beginning in 2013, includes the massacre in its historical accounting of British colonial violence in the Caribbean. The British government has not engaged substantively with this framework. King Charles III visited Barbados in 2021, during the country's transition to a republic. The address at the ceremony acknowledged colonialism in general terms. The Morant Bay Massacre was not named. The archive problem at the center of this story is this. Everything we initially learned about the Morant Bay Rebellion was recorded by the colonial administration. The royal commission that Eyre himself requested, which mildly censured him while recommending no criminal prosecution, wrote its reports within an institutional framework that required the rebellion to have been dangerous enough to justify the response, and the response not to have been so brutal that it constituted murder. The survivor testimonies that exist in historical archives came to us largely through the Jamaica Committee's collection efforts in 1866. They survive in fragments and are incomplete. Bogle's own voice is not fully recoverable from this record. What we know of what he said comes from reports of speeches, from letters written in his name, and from testimony about his words by others. The colonial archive recorded him as a threat to be eliminated. The nationalist archive recorded him as a martyr to be elevated. The man himself, in his own continuous voice, is not there. What the documentary record does give us, clearly and without reasonable dispute, is the sequence. Bogle asked for justice through every available official channel over a period of years. Each channel refused him. He organized. He marched. The response was 40 days of systematic killing. And when England was given the legal mechanism to name that killing for what the evidence showed it to be, England found new reasons each time not to use it. The historical question that 160 years since Morant Bay cannot quite close is whether what happened was a failure of individuals, a governor who exceeded his authority, a parliament that found procedural cover for its preferences, courts that shaped their rulings to protect the structure of empire, or whether it was empire operating correctly. Not breaking down, not going rogue, just doing what it had always been built to do, in the open, on the record, with legal language available whenever the question was asked. Did the system fail, Paul Bogle and George William Gordon, or did it work exactly as designed?